Thank you, everyone, for your patience. We are now recording this call for educational purposes. During the presentation, please keep your phone on mute to minimize outside noises. Last time we actually had, somehow we had music coming on, although I think everyone was trying to mute. So please do mute your call. If you have to put a call on hold and go offside, please actually just go ahead and hang up because we can actually hear the music on your hold. There are plenty of spaces. We have a good conference call line, so you can always call back in and be able to listen to the call. Please do not put, that was it. So before we begin, what I'd like to do is do a slight overview of what we're going to be talking about today. Basically, the agenda is we will introduce our speaker. I'll ask you a little bit about what you'd like to hear on the call just to make sure that we're covering those topics. And then we will go to our speaker who will do sort of an overview of her organization and sort of a recent survey that they conducted. And then we will go into a Q&A from the moderator about questions that we will answer around the cost of stress. Then we're going to open it up to everyone on the call, and you should have plenty of time to answer questions. And then we'll just do a quick wrap-up. So our speaker on the call today, our topic is, again, the cost of stress on employers and working women. It will discuss the cost of stress, both monetary and physical, on both employers and working women. Our speaker today is Geralyn Ross, MALICSW, President and CEO of Anxiety Disorders Associations of America. You can find out more information about them at www.adaa.org. Before we go into our programming, are there any questions from our listeners up front that you want to make sure that we cover today? Okay, good. Geralyn, I'm just going to turn this over to you and let you do an introduction of your organization and some of the work that you're doing.
Great. Thank you very much. And nice to be here with everybody. Well, the organization I run is called the Anxiety Disorders Association of America. We've actually been around since 1979, and we are a group, an interesting combination of both professional clinicians, researchers, people in the field, mental health field, primarily, of course, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, and also consumers. So we kind of, since we began, we've done things for various groups at various times, but mainly our mission has remained the same, and our mission is to promote the prevention, treatment, and cure of anxiety disorders and to improve the lives of all people who suffer from them. So we have a huge public education campaign. We have annual conferences. We have scientific meetings. We have a 50-person scientific advisory board. We do a number of publications, media things. Our real interest is getting the word out to people that anxiety disorders are real, they're serious, and they're treatable. And, you know, we've done everything from testifying before Congress to, you know, publishing in journals to promoting books and writing books and papers. So we're very much interested in everything that has to do with anxiety disorders. People tend to think of anxiety disorders as being trivial, not so serious, not as, you know, not something, you know, the worried well, and especially in women where they look at anxiety disorders often as, well, it's just, you know, it's not a real illness, it's just pull up your bootstraps. So we've been working real hard for the last almost 30 years now trying to get people to understand that these are real serious disorders that have consequences, both physical and certainly monetarily, and impact every aspect of life, family, employment, school. And so one of the things that we did this year, we did a survey. We have a stress-out week at the end of November, and we did a national survey. And the reason we call it stress-out is because over the years, I do a lot of media work, and every time I get a phone call from the press, one of the first questions they ask is, what's the difference between normal stress and anxiety and an anxiety disorder? And I go into the explanation, you know, we all have anxiety, we all have stress, but here's what an anxiety disorder is. It's a pathological stress when it interferes greatly in your life and it impacts everything you do and you avoid things because of it. And so we decide as an organization to sort of preempt all those questions and come out with a stress out week, and we're saying, okay, everybody has stress. Let's get the word out about what stress is, and as we get that word out, let's also look at when do people need to know that distress isn't normal? When do they need to do something about it? So we wanted to cast a really wide net of getting people to understand the role of stress in their lives. So we did this survey called a stress and anxiety disorder survey in the workplace, and we wanted to find out how does stress impact people in the workplace. And just I'm going to address a couple of key findings, and then as we go through the conference, I may be referring to some other findings we had with as some of the questions are asked. But a couple of things are interesting. First of all, we found that 82%, and we looked at women, by the way, 82% of working women experience stress or anxiety in their daily lives. The majority of them say that it interferes with their lives at least moderately. It's a pretty high number. A third of the women with stress and anxiety in their life every day have taken prescription medication to manage it. Or if they're not directly just managing the stress, they're trying to manage a secondary problem like it may be lack of sleep because of the anxiety. Less than half of the women who say that their stress interferes with their work have talked to their employer about it. So more than 50% of people are quietly suffering with stress and anxiety, and we asked them, why is it that you're not able to talk to your employer? And the most common, here are the five or six most common things that people told us. One is that they're afraid that their bosses would interpret it as an unwillingness to do something or as a lack of interest. So they look at it as the boss will think I'm just trying to get out of something, so I don't want to be perceived as someone who doesn't want to take on my responsibilities. The next most common one is they were afraid of being labeled as weak. You know, my boss will see me as someone who is just not quite up to the job, or I just can't get the thing done. The next thing was that they were afraid it would go in their file. They felt they would be labeled. They were also afraid it would affect promotion opportunities, that they would be passed over. So, for example, someone who may have mentioned to their boss they have a problem with public speaking may feel that as a result of that they weren't promoted to manager. Or maybe they talked about a fear of flying, and as a result of that they weren't, you know, sent on certain trips where they could have, gone up the ladder a little more. So, and then the last one, which came up, you know, in the sort of top group was the fear of being laughed at or of not being taken seriously. And this we know is a problem in general with women with many disorders. We've seen it with depression, we've seen it with cardiovascular disease, and with anxiety disorders, people are particularly sensitive to the fear that people will just dismiss them. Now, what's happened is about 41% of the people we surveyed, the women we surveyed, say that this persistent stress or the excessive anxiety that was in their lives, it was there all the time. So 41% are feeling it all the time in their daily lives, persistent stress, anxiety, physical symptoms, psychological symptoms. And about a quarter of them say that this persistent stress or anxiety has impaired their ability to function in the last 6 months. Pretty high numbers. And yet, what's interesting is that despite all of this, what we found, only 11% have been diagnosed with an anxiety disorder. So, and a smaller percentage of that have not gone for any kind of treatment. So, the take home from this is that these are real serious disorders that interfere with daily life that can be treated, and yet such a small amount of people are actually getting help. And one of the things that we're hoping to do as a result of our Stress That Week and all the other activities I'll shorten and say ADAA for Anxiety Disorders Association of America, one of the things we're hoping people will do through this survey and this program is be aware that they may have a treatable disorder, and also some of the things that employers can do to help people feel more sort of safe and secure in talking to whether it's HR people or their boss about their problem. So I'm going to stop there, and then we can move on.
Excellent. You've talked about the survey and some of the reasons people don't feel comfortable talking about stress at work, but work is stressful. That's just the reality of it. Jalen, what are some of the major sources of stress at work that you've found?
Well, the thing that that the women told us in the survey, and I think probably any of us in the workforce can understand that these all seem like really obvious, the one that was the highest, got the highest number of as a stressor are deadlines. And that was including things where they have to make last-minute changes to things, they have to meet the deadlines, they have to set the deadlines. A lot of it seemed to center around deadlines, where people felt that absolute horrible pressure. The next one was interpersonal relationships with their peers, with their superiors, with their subordinates, where people just felt this tremendous stress about, you know, a problem with their office mate or their boss or someone they were supervising. And then the third area that was most stressful had to do with staff management, hiring people, firing, evaluating employees, training new employees, and then dealing with issues that arise just, you know, throughout the day, financial issues, customer issues, technical issues. And what we found is that most people said that the stress and anxiety on the job most often affect workplace performance, relationships with peers and coworkers, quality of work, and relationships with supervisors. So I think, you know, while there are a lot of other areas that we can probably all think about, these are the ones that the women told us in the survey were the most stressful to them.
Hmm. So when you're dealing with these kinds of stress at work, and you're dealing, you know, deadlines exist, challenging coworkers or customers exist, how do you manage stress at work, or try not to take the stress home with you?
Well, let me. I can sort of give you over the years as I'm a clinician. I also run an anxiety disorders practice, so I can sort of put my clinical hat as well as my patient advocacy hat on. And let me tell you a couple of things that I've pulled together that I think that I use generally with patients when we're trying to come up with a stress management program. I think we all know the basic, you know, eat well and get your exercise and prioritize. But I want to try to go through a couple of things which I hope will be helpful to the listeners that are sort of specific. So the first thing I always encourage people to do is really assess what the stressors are and looking at how you respond to them. So the first thing you want to do is make a list of all the current things in your life that are producing stress at work. And here we're talking specifically about work. So, you know, whatever it is, even if it's something that seems ludicrous and doesn't make any sense, just make that list. Put them all on there. I don't care how long it is. And then you want to ask yourself, how do I normally cope with these stressful things? What do I do? You know, is my way of coping healthy? Is it unhealthy? You know, for example, do I, you know, exercise? Do I, you know, use alcohol, abuse alcohol or drugs? What do I do about downtime for self-care? Do I take care of myself? Do I balance work and play? Do I procrastinate? You know, how do I manage my time? How do I organize things? Do I overeat? Do I get up from my desk and run all the time to deal with, you know, with overeating? So we ask people to really get I want patients to get or employees to get a whole picture. So I often have them just keep a chart or a diary, and I find that rather than giving them forms, everybody has sort of their own way of doing it. So I just tell them, you figure out how to do it, but I want to know, you know, what are the things that are stressful to you and what are you doing now? And then they bring it back and we start having them, you know, after they've identified what all their stresses are and how they cope with it, we start to say, okay, what are the things we can change and how can we modify it? So I ask people to be aware of what are your physical, your psychophysiological, what are your emotional reactions to stress? What happens to you? What happens to your body? What do you feel? What happens in your mind? What are you thinking? And then you want to recognize what you can change. For example, internal thoughts. Like when there's a deadline, you can either go, oh, my goodness, there's a deadline. I can't do it. I hate this. I better get up and eat something. I better walk around. I better, you know, I never get it done on time. Instead of saying, you know, instead of being able to do something to say, okay, I've got to make a list. I've got to prioritize. I've got to shut out other things that are going on to distract me. So we have them identify what their style is of how they cope. And then we, you know, talk about using healthy coping skills and using good skills rather than negative ones. So, for example, we would look at what kind of relaxation techniques can work. And I think it's very important when we do an individual plan for people to not just generalize and tell everybody they should go for walks. Well, you know, if you work in a, you know, an area, a country where it's freezing cold most of the year and, you know, you're at the 40th floor of a high-rise building and it takes you 10 minutes to get down and out, you can't tell, you know, an employee to just go out and take a walk. For some people, it might be meeting lunch for a friend, or it might be just going in a corner and reading a book or listening to music, or making sure when they get home at night they take a bath. So I think it's important for people to look at what will work for them in their lifestyle. And then, you know, to be really realistic about it. You know, if taking a walk is something you can do, which of course is wonderful, be realistic about how much time. You know, can I really take a half hour every day? And if you can, you have to build that into your schedule as if it were actually part of what your responsibilities on the job was. And it really should be incorporated into the daily routine. I tell people, take your planning book the same way you have, you know, meeting with so-and-so at 11 o'clock, you know, 11:30, report due, 12 o'clock, walk or listen to music or read a book. That people should build it in and not feel guilty about taking time for that. And then really, you know, anything, any kind of relaxation techniques, you know, meditation, guided imagery, deep breathing, progressive relaxation, any one of those, they all get to the same place. They all get people to sit quietly or to let their body, their mind calm down. So we encourage all of those. And again, I tell people their assignment is go out this week and explore what available options are there for you. You know, can you run and take a lunchtime class, or do you want to get a book and just learn how to relax or do some guided imagery by yourself? And then decide what works best for you and do it every day. You know, you do not allow yourself not to do it. And then, you know, basic stress management techniques, we look at both mind and body. So, you know, we talk about aerobic exercise. There are studies showing that up to 50% of our anxiety can be decreased by doing aerobic exercise. I think we all know that. Good nutrition, adequate amounts of sleep each night, reducing caffeine. People with, particularly if they have an anxiety disorder, caffeine can trigger panic attacks and people prone to it, so we tell people to watch their caffeine. Of course, their alcohol intake, one of the things that people often don't realize that when they drink a lot, where alcohol may relax you at night, you know, while you're drinking, you may feel good and you may even have a hangover the next day a little bit, but you may also, if you're prone to severe anxiety, have anxiety attacks, panic attacks the next day after going out and drinking. So we ask people, it's not just the normal hangover and, you know, the sloppy behavior and all the other consequences, but it can also provoke panic attacks. And then we really recommend things like biofeedback. Acupuncture is wonderful. And then, you know, in terms of just the mind, you know, we want people to learn how to handle if they have multiple stressors, how to prioritize things, how to initiate a time management schedule, how to break tasks down. And again, I do all of this by having people writing this and you know, creating forms for themselves that will work. Looking at what has to be done first, identifying goals, and then developing a support network. And we really encourage people who are in like HR and counselors and, you know, employees assistant programs, I mean, people who for whom these people may come to with other disorders, we really encourage people to ask questions like, you know, do you feel anxious a lot of the time, more than you think other people do or more than you feel you should? And to kind of give people permission to speak about their anxiety and not feel as if they're being put down or dismissed because of it.
Sure, Lynn. Actually, we're going to go into a little more depth around as these issues become, you know, not just everyday workplace stress, but as they evolve into anxiety and things that affect employers as well as employees. But just briefly before we go into that, you touched on it a little bit. What if someone's a manager or executive director of an organization or of a team, what are just a couple of maybe like two or three bullet point things that they could do to make people feel more comfortable on their team about being able to take the time to do what they need to do to deal with stress, like taking that 15 minutes to read the book or go for a walk or do what they needed to do? How can they set that up so that culture allows people to feel like they can take that time?
Well, I think probably one of the most effective ways of doing that is role modeling. I think it's very hard for an employee to have a boss who says, you know, I think you ought to take 15 minutes, you know, to relax, and yet the employee sees the boss, you know, never coming up for air. So I think modeling is very important. And I know it's hard, especially, you know, people are in managerial positions and they're setting examples, and there's this kind of funny double standard. People feel, well, I've got to set an example about how hard everybody needs to work here, but I want to tell people they should take time off. So I think it's important that employers should do that. And that's a way of giving employees permission. I think also there should be discussion about it. I think it should be initiated by the employer. I know even in my own, in my clinical practice, and also in our national organization where we have, you know, a staff of like 10, 12 people, I will often say to them, you know what, I want you to tell me, what would make you feel, what would you like to do for 15 minutes, a half hour each day that would really make you feel good? You know, if you could do this. And they'll often say simple things, you know, call a friend, you know, look at my email, play, you know, do Sudoku or, you know, take a yoga class, and need a little more than 15, 20 minutes. But, you know, however long it is, whatever, you know, whatever makes sense. And then I say to them, you know what, you got to do that, and I'm going to make you do that. If you don't do that, I'm going to consider you not doing your job. And, you know, we kind of use humor with it, and we try to kind of get people to see it's okay. But it's giving them permission and taking the, you know, when someone's a boss or perceived as a boss, we sometimes forget how intimidated people are and how polite people will be and how everybody wants to, you know, not look like they're goofing off. And so I think it's our responsibility as a boss to tell people it's okay, to discuss it, to talk to them about it, and to build it into the day and to really reward them. I mean, I'll often hear myself saying to somebody, I'm so glad you took an hour this morning to go do what you had to do. Now, obviously, you're not going to say that to someone who takes advantage of it and who's not getting their work done. But I find that most people in the workplace, the people who are really good workers, they don't take advantage, and they won't take the breaks unless you really tell them. So I think breaks and stress reduction things should be almost mandatory, you know, in the way that people feel okay and maybe even show some interest in it. I think it's great if an employer says to an employee, I heard you're taking a yoga class. You know, gee, what's that like? You know, yoga's supposed to be terrific. Tell me about it. Or, you know, I'm so glad that, you know, you're taking time off, you know, during the day to, you know, do something relaxing, whatever it is. But I think it should be encouraged. It should be supported. It should be people should make it like it's something that's good, that it's not something that people have to hide.
So as we sort of deal with the everyday stress and we're able to reduce some of that, hopefully, how do we know, either as an employer trying to assist someone or as the employee ourselves or friend of one, what's the difference between normal everyday workplace stress and anxiety and something that's more serious, specifically an anxiety disorder? Mm-hmm. And as an anxiety disorder, how does that, versus regular stress, which we've talked about, how does that affect the work employment of the person who's suffering?
Well, anxiety disorders themselves are, I mean, the term is an umbrella term for a group of medical conditions, you know, panic disorder, phobias, social anxiety disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, and post-traumatic stress disorder. And each of them have different symptoms and different behaviors. What they all have in common, with the exception of post-traumatic stress disorder, which is more when somebody's been exposed to some kind of horrific, horrible, traumatic event, or they've witnessed it, or and they have symptoms, and I'll talk about that in a second. But all of the other ones, phobias, panic, OCD, generalized anxiety, what all of those have in common is that the person is aware that the anxiety, that the fear is irrational, and yet it's interfering in their lives, and they're accommodating the anxiety. So, for example, somebody with obsessive-compulsive disorder in the workplace may at first appear to be a very, very, very good worker. I mean, every I is dotted. They never leave the office till everything is done. You hand them something to get done, it's done, and it's done over and over and over again. What happens, though, often is at a tremendous, tremendous pain to the person with it. And I think when you see, you know, and sometimes a lot, and the other thing, a lot of these disorders, the person works so hard to hide it because they're so ashamed, they're so embarrassed. I had a patient one time who was an accountant, and he had OCD. And so his employer thought it was wonderful that he stayed nights and he stayed weekends, and there were times he slept in the office. And, of course, when he came into my office and he told me that he was doing that because he could not leave, he never felt satisfied, even though everything balanced and checked. And as part of treatment, I actually had him go and talk to his employer, and we had to do some pretty big education there. and that the employer, and he had a contract that he would leave at a certain time, that if he wasn't sure if his work was correct, there would be someone he could show it to and go over it with him. And we actually included the, in this case, a very sympathetic, empathetic employer in some of the treatment planning. You know, people with social anxiety disorder, you know, we all know the employee or our coworker who never comes to lunch with us and never, you know, doesn't like talking on the phone and making initiating calls, or who, you know, says yes to everything and doesn't challenge everything, but is very always afraid of doing the wrong thing or saying the wrong thing, or won't give a speech, or and oftentimes these people have social phobia or social anxiety disorder. It's called both. And so, you know, we look at what's the difference between, you know, a normally socially anxious person or someone who's normally afraid to give a talk. Well, the difference is most of us, when we know we're going to get up and give a speech, have some anxiety. It's the anxiety that helps us, you know, prepare our notes, rehearse, practice, you know, worry about how we're going to look and how, you know, make sure we talk slowly, like I don't do, things like that. And, you know, we sort of prepare to get everything organized. And so the anxiety helps us. But for someone with a true social phobia or a social anxiety disorder, the fear is so strong and so severe and so overwhelming that the person will avoid doing, will not do it, and they'll often be manipulative about it. They'll say something to their coworker like, you know, yeah, I had this chance to go to, you know, fly out to, you know, this wonderful resort, and I was asked to give a talk, but, you know, I don't, you know, I really don't want to take the time off. Why don't you go for me? So often it's hidden, and if you start to see an employee who is avoiding things and trying to get out of things and having other people do it, especially, you know, oftentimes it's someone who is perfectly competent to do it, but you begin to see, you know, every time someone's supposed to lead a meeting, they seem to get the flu that morning. You know, you might, as an employee, approach the employer, approach them and say, you know, I noticed that, you know, you seem not to kind of like public speaking. You know, is there something I can help you with? And sometimes employers and employees or, you know, or even peers can come up with ways of actually helping each other. But I think it can impact every aspect. I mean, people with generalized anxiety disorder worry about everything. And so, you know, there your employee who comes in the morning and worries about things that worries about everybody else's jobs and worries about everything on their plate, and whatever is wrong, it's exaggerated. We think of them as sort of the chronic worriers. And with people like that, again, you know, we may suggest, you know, sometimes it sounds as if, you know, all the things that are going on here right now seem very overwhelming, or there are ways that we can look at sort of what's realistic and what are the areas that we're worrying about unnecessarily and kind of help pull back.
Wow. You had talked a little bit about the scope of stress at work, that, you know, something like 82% of the working women in your survey said that they experienced stress, and a large percentage of them sort of it affected their work life or their home life. What is thinking about the scope of it, what is the cost to, say, employers of having stressed employees, and then even more so employees with anxiety disorders in the workplace?
Well, we did at ADAA, we did a study a couple of years ago, and it was we commissioned this study called The Economic Burden of Anxiety Disorders. And based on the information that we gathered from that, what we learned was that anxiety disorders cost the United States more than $42 billion a year. And about a third of those, or about $148 billion, oh, wait a second. I said my number screwed up. I'm sorry. Take that back. Well, that number is about a third of all of the total cost for mental health in the United States. So, but anxiety disorders alone are about $42 billion. And most of that money is going towards a few things. The highest number, now with depression, as I recall in that study, when depression was looked at as well, they found that the highest cost had to do with worker absenteeism. And with anxiety disorders, it's different. That's still a high cost, but the highest cost is frequent utilization of the healthcare system, which drives up you know, the healthcare benefits. Because what happens is typically people with anxiety disorders go from doctor to doctor to doctor. The average number of health professionals seen by someone with an anxiety disorder is usually about 10 before they're diagnosed. So they go to for example, cardiologists thinking they're having heart attacks. They go to neurologists thinking they have brain tumors. They go to endocrinologists thinking it's their thyroid. They end up in hospital emergency rooms many times thinking, again, they're having cardiovascular problems. And so people go from doctor to doctor to doctor until they finally have this, diagnosed and have very elaborate workups. And what typically happens is at the end of all that, they finally find someone who says, aha, you know, we ruled out everything. It's probably, we think it's an anxiety disorder. And then they give them the name of someone to get treated, and they find out their insurance doesn't cover it. They don't have, high enough mental health benefits. So it's really a huge problem. We also see, of course, the worker, absenteeism. But it's not as common with anxiety disorders. I mean, you will have some people, for example, when they have agoraphobia, which is results from when people have panic attacks and then they start avoiding more and more places as a result of the fear of having another panic attack. So sometimes these people can go to work and come home, but don't ask them to travel, don't ask them to go downtown to another office, don't ask them to do anything. They're kind of territorial bound. And in some cases, the agoraphobia can get so bad that the people actually can't come to work and they can become, in extreme cases, housebound. But for the most part, I think where it impacts is people, not being able to do the job, not being able to give the talk, not being able to fly, or maybe they have to go to a meeting where they drive over bridges and they're phobic about bridges or tunnels, or they can't use public transportation. So it's more of a nuisance than anything. With OCD, of course, people can spend hours and hours. So I think that it can pretty much cost employees. We've seen it where I've actually had from time to time patients coming in and asking if I can write letters to them to have disability because of their anxiety disorders. And, philosophically I'm against that because what it ends up doing is it allows the person not to get help and they become disabled. And as you all know, becoming disabled and not taking care of the problem, becoming sort of professionally on disability becomes a real problem. And so I'll often say to them, you go someplace and get, if not here necessarily, wherever you can get treatment, wherever you want to go treatment, do 10 sessions of treatment. And at the end of 10 sessions, I'll talk with your therapist. You can give them permission to talk with me. And if we feel that you are truly disabled by this and need time off, then we will do it. But almost every time that happens, the person then comes back and says, I'm so glad I didn't take disability because people don't really want to not work. People don't want to be home. They want to work, and they're embarrassed, and they're ashamed, and they feel brought down by this.
Well, Sherilyn, I actually have a number of questions that I'd still like to ask, but I also want to make sure that the people on the call get an opportunity to ask questions as well. So at this point, what I'm going to do is sort of a combination. I'm going to open it up to anyone else on the call. If you have any questions at this point about anxiety disorders, effect on the workplace or worker, please let us know. Feel free to ask, and then I'll also sort of intersperse it with the questions that I have. Does anyone have any questions on the call at this point of anything that Sherilyn has already talked to us about? Anyone have any questions about something that's happening in your workplace that you'd like some insight into? Okay. As you talked some about sort of the effects on the employers of employees who may not feel like they can, fulfill everything that they need to do at the workplace, can't go and give a talk or, travel. What can employers do to help an employee with an anxiety disorder?
Well, I think the most helpful thing, of course, is opening a dialogue and having the employee feel secure enough that they can come to them, that they won't be judged. So I think if the employer can really listen and pick up, there are signals, there are things going on. So someone who's, constantly, let's say, late for meetings, instead of, the sort of, normal reaction is, why are you late? You've been late a lot and what's going on? To sort of do it in a way that says, sometimes, you've recently been late, and I'm just wondering if there's a problem. I it would just help me to understand it, because then we can talk about it. Or, so much of it depends on, of course, the relationship between the employer and the employee, and the size of the organization, and how, what how comfortable the employee would feel opening up. So sometimes it may be better to have, you know, like an HR person or an EAP person bring it up. Like, if there's an EAP or HR person in a company, I would suggest that the employer bring it to their attention. And then maybe the employer might say, you know, there seems to be some problems lately. You know, I'd really love you to go and talk to so-and-so and see if you can't, you know, get a little bit of help for it. And I understand, you know, just to sort of show that it's okay to have a problem, it's okay to get help. And then it would be up to the EAP or HR person to really bring the subject up.
If an employee is feeling, or there's an HR person, or you're with a colleague, and they're feeling that maybe this isn't something that their employer is able to help them with, mm-hmm. how should they seek help on their own? What should they do? At least, what should their first steps be?
Well, I think first thing is to get educated. You know, we have a wonderful website. I think you mentioned it. It's adaa.org. We have a lot of resources on there. For example, people can go on the site and they can take, we have these little self-tests. So they can take these self-tests, they can put in what their symptoms are, and then they can see whether in fact they might meet the criteria for one of the anxiety disorders. And then we recommend that they then take that self-test to a mental health professional, psychologist, psychiatrist, or social worker, or to their primary care doctor and say, hey, I seem to have these things. Sometimes, again, I think doing that, it makes them feel like it's real. They're not the only one. It's legitimate, and they bring it in, and it also opens the way for discussion. And it's something that I think, you know, even HR or you know, EAPs can use that. You know, feel free to, you know, download it and use it and just say, you know, ask somebody to sort of, have you experienced any of these and, you know, recently these symptoms. You know, another thing is that also on the website, there is a place where people can put their zip code and get the names of health professionals in their cities and towns who specialize in treating anxiety disorders. And so it might be worth just going and having a consultation. And there have been times where, you know, people with an anxiety disorder may have gone just for a couple of sessions. This isn't long-term therapy. I mean, and I can, if you want, get into a little bit about the kind of treatments we do, but basically, treatments are very successful. They're very short-term, you know, 10, 12, 15 sessions. And sometimes patients can come in for just a few sessions just to get educated and to understand what's wrong. They may want to use, there are a lot of self-help books that are listed on the, you know, I've written one called Triumph Over Fear. There are tons of them listed on our on the ADA website or on Amazon. There are workbooks, there are programs. So there are a lot of things people can do to get started. But the most important thing is getting educated and understand, you know, what it is. The fact that, for example, many people think that if they have an anxiety disorder, they're going to just, you know, go crazy. They're going to die from it. They're going to, you know, do something awful. And it's so helpful when they can read and they find out that, yes, the feelings are frightening. They're not dangerous. However, if people have chronic anxiety, they need to know that while it won't cause other illnesses, it certainly can exacerbate them. And we know now, for example, that there are studies showing that people with anxiety disorders, have a higher prevalence, but it could be a trigger in terms of people vulnerable to cardiovascular disease. It goes along with things like asthma, irritable bowel. So there are a lot of, and depression, of course, there are a lot of secondary consequences to not identifying and treating an anxiety disorder. We know that chronic anxiety and panic attacks, anxiety attacks, are one of the predictors now we're learning in completed suicide attempts. You know, people who are depressed and complete suicide have a higher level of anxiety symptoms, chronic anxiety, and so we're starting to screen for that. So I think it's important for people to get educated, to do some self-tests, to read some self-help books, workbooks, to get the names of somebody near them, and at least go and get a consultation. And I also tell people before they do anything, any kind of therapy, just go and make sure you have a good physical, a good, you know, medical checkup, and just to rule out any medical diseases. One of the things that happens is a lot of the symptoms of anxiety disorders also mimic many of the symptoms of medical illnesses. So, and I never would say to a patient, no, don't worry, you're not having a heart attack. But, you know, if an employee comes in and it's a, you know, 60-year-old man who, you know, who has a family history of heart disease and he's having chest palpitations, you're going to send him to the ER. That's different than a 21-year-old, you know, young woman, you know, perfectly healthy who three times last week was in the ER thinking she's having a heart attack. So you can treat them differently.
You had mentioned a little bit earlier about some of the resources available if you're an HR person on your website. What are some of the other things if someone is working with employees in HR or other divisions, and what are some of the resources they have available to help them figure out how to help people with anxiety in the workplace or to make a less stressful workplace?
Well, I think, again, you know, some of the things that we have on our site, for example, we have a lot of booklets, a lot of pamphlets that we can give to people, which, you know, they're welcome to go on the site and download. We have newsletters. We have a lot of material. We have, you know, for example, we sell the, you know, the bands, like the wristbands that people wear to show support, the Triumph bands, which we found has been one of the things that people have told us. It's been really great. People buy the Triumph bands, they wear them, and everybody comes up and says, oh, what is that? And, you know, people say, well, this is, you know, for anxiety disorders. And the next thing you know, they're saying, oh, wow, I have one. And that opens up a dialogue. So we found those very helpful. We have calendars. We're at the end of the year now, but the information in there is very helpful in terms of tips for dealing with it. And we also have conferences, continuing education programs. We have a conference in March coming up, which is in the middle of the country this year, St. Louis, where we bring together about 700 mental health professionals, all focused on anxiety disorders across disciplines, and talk about the latest treatments and, you know, resources. And so anybody that has a real interest in that, we would recommend come to that. And of course, the CME program. And I think there's so much information out there that, you know, like the government, NIMH has some very wonderful resources on their website on you know, I guess gov.org. I know we're linked on my site. I don't remember the exact reference, but the government has some very good information. And I think there are tons of wonderful books. But I think for, you know, someone who's an employer who really wants to learn, I think there's enough stuff on either the ADA website or the government website. There's enough information that I think would give them the tools to at least start a dialogue. And there are booklets, brochures that we would be happy to, you know, get out to people if they wanted them. That sometimes just even having it in the office is really helpful.
So we've talked a little bit about the sort of back and forth perspectives of the employees and the employers, and so we talked a little bit about what each can do in terms of, you know, helping create less stressful workplaces. If we do find that one of our employees has an anxiety disorder, or if we find out we're an employee with an anxiety disorder, you touched on this a little bit about what sort of the treatment plan is. What are some of the options available for us? And what should an employer expect as someone goes through treatment? Mm-hmm. Is it a long-term sort of thing that they'll be assisting the employee with, or sort of what does that sort of arc of assistance look like?
Well, I think, you know, one of the things that happens, I think a lot of people hear the word mental health or, you know, therapy, and they immediately think of, you know, 5 years on the couch, you know, five times a day. And most treatments, as you know, today are, you know, very targeted, they're short-term, And they work. I mean, patients get better. It's probably one of the reasons I love being a clinician in this field, because there's very little burnout, because we're constantly seeing people turn their lives around. And the two basic types of treatment that we use that have you know, evidence-based, that have been shown over and over and over again to successfully treat anxiety disorders, one is what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, and the other is the use of medications. And oftentimes we will use them together. Cognitive behavioral therapy, as I'm sure many you know people on the call know, it's a short-term treatment where we help people identify or modify the thoughts, the feelings, the behaviors, and then you know and really look at what am I saying that's keeping my anxiety awake? What are the cues I'm giving myself? You know, how am I responding? And then in the behavioral part is actually teaching people to confront the anxiety and to actually experience it. So as a clinician, I may spend, you know, a good part of my time with the patient in the field, you know, on elevators, escalators, at Toastmasters, at, you know, going to lunch with them, you know, looking at what are the situations that you're avoiding, and then actually desensitizing them right while they're experiencing it. So We don't look very much about what are the causes. We know that the causes are a combination of a person's genetics, their physiological makeup, their personality, their environment. And we don't really go back and look at, you know, unless it's post-traumatic stress disorder where someone has been exposed to something horrific and there was a trigger. But most anxiety disorders seem to come, they appear to come out of the blue. They generally start late teens, early 20s. They affect twice as many women as men. They usually there's a first degree relative with an anxiety disorder, not necessarily the same one, but something similar. So we know that these have, you know, genetic, biological components. And what we try to do then is we look at what are the symptoms and how is the anxiety disorder interfering with your life. So, for example, if I had a patient who, let's say, couldn't use the elevator and couldn't go to work, you know, because their office was on a high floor, we wouldn't spend a lot of time talking about, you know, why they don't like elevators or what happened when they were a child or why they developed claustrophobia. What we would do is we'd say, okay, when you even think about it, when you even anticipate thinking about an elevator, going to an elevator, what happens, you know, your anxiety goes up, what are the thoughts, what are the reactions you're having, you know, all, these are just feelings, and we demonstrate to people that they're not going to go crazy, they're not going to lose control, and to show that and to desensitize them, I would actually go to the office building with the patient, and we might start, depending on where that, we always look at where the patient is coming from, so if it's someone who cannot go in an elevator at all, we might start by just standing by the elevator. I had one woman who could not even touch the button on an elevator, so I would press the button and I would have her hold my other hand. She wouldn't touch the hand with the button on, and that's where we begin. Others, we can go in the elevator, but not by themselves. So we would start together, and then I would have them do it by themselves. So we're doing a very intense sort of implosion where the whole goal of therapy is exposing people to the feelings that are frightening them and for them seeing for themselves that they're frightening and not dangerous. And this is very effective and it's quick. So as I said earlier, 12 to 15 sessions is generally what people recommend for cognitive behavioral therapy. Most of the time it's done in less than that. We can do that.
Cool. That is a concern that some employers do have, is that sort of long-term care might keep people out or be something that they have to deal with for a long time, but it's...
And it shouldn't be.
Fear that it's...
No, I think, you know, and sometimes I'll have people come in, and of course, you know, my practice is here in Washington, D.C., where, you know, nobody could ever leave their job, and it's, you know, there's no place in the world where people feel more, you know, I can't even take 5 minutes to, you know, to go for a walk, let alone come in for therapy. And what employers have found, and certainly, you know, when we talk to people on the other side, you know, beside the patient, sometimes we've gotten permission, and employers actually, in a few cases, come in and been sort of a help part of the treatment because they've sort of, you know, helped encourage some of the desensitization. And what they found is in the long run, you know, to have an employee go out, let's say, you know, once a week for 10, 12 weeks and do therapy, in the long run, the reward afterwards, both personally to the employee and then, of course, even to the business in terms of the value the employee has and the financial reward, has